Will your life change if BHP Billiton takes over Rio Tinto? They made a second offer, 3.4 shares per share, and it's been knocked back. There are concerns in plenty of foreign parts on it, and to explain them and where we go from here, Stephen Mayne, business editor at crikey.com.au. Good morning, Stephen.
Hi, Coxie. How are you?
Very well. Great talking to you. And is the BHP, what used to be the Big Australian, going to become the even bigger, whatever it is now, South African, Australian, American entity?
Yes, well, it is the ultimate globalised entity. It's only 40% Australian-owned, and Rio Tinto is 15% Australian-owned. So if they put the two together, we'll have a $400 billion company that will be about 20 to 25% Australian-owned, run out of Melbourne. So not a huge impact, you know, on regular Australians. I mean, obviously, if they've got a shareholding, it would be the biggest company on the market, so every super fund would own BHP shares. But the major opposition obviously comes from the customers, from the Chinese and the Japanese, who are just worried that this mega monster corporation would jack up the price of coal and iron ore and aluminium and uranium and copper and everything else, because they just have so much power.
Some of those resources contracts I was reading yesterday in The Australian, I think it was, have just leapt in value anyway. What's feeding what, and where might a new Rio Tinto BHP Billiton entity take them in the future, perhaps, if it goes ahead?
Well, I mean, most of those prices have doubled, and some of them have even tripled, particularly iron ore and coal. And basically, that's all driven by China. I mean, China is just having this massive urbanisation, industrialisation process, and particularly the Pilbara. It's just literally the lifeblood of Chinese industrialisation, because we're already producing more than 400 million tonnes a year of iron ore out of the Pilbara. And that's projected to go up to well above 600 million in a decade or so. So it's just an incredible amount of Aussie dirt building China is the bottom line of this. And if it's one company controlling the whole negotiation, then we'll have even more price rises, and we'll make even the owners of BHP make even more profit. So hence the Chinese are particularly paranoid about that.
Mm. What does it mean for that resources sector in Australia, particularly, I guess, in WA, but for our economy in a larger sense?
Well, it is interesting, Tim. We are in the middle of an amazing resources boom, but few people realise that that about 80% of Australia's resources sector is actually already foreign-owned. So, for instance, the world's biggest gold mine, the Kalgoorlie Super Pit, is 100% foreign-owned. All those famous mines at Mount Isa are Swiss-owned. The North West Shelf Gas Project is only 10% Australian-owned. So basically, if you created a monster in BHP, it would be good that it's based in Australia and that it would be 25% Australian-owned, and you know, the profits that would flow to BHP would be absolutely huge. But equally, a lot of those profits would head offshore, and you really would have the ultimate globalised corporation selling its resources from mines all over the world to customers all over the world.
Yeah, all right. Where would it leave regulators? Where would it leave governments? Where would it leave the Western Australian state government, for example? Where might it leave each of us? Would we be, you know, riding a new wave, perhaps, Stephen?
Well, I think there's tough issues for regulators. I mean, Australia has a pretty sorry record of having concentrated corporate sectors. You know, you look at banking or supermarkets or the power of Westfield, mega media. You know, it's a bit of an unfortunate tradition in Australia. And we would be taking this tradition even further to have an absolute monster mining company. So, for instance, if you look at the Pilbara, which I think is actually the heart and soul of this takeover bit, it's all about putting the two operations together in the Pilbara and making billions from flogging iron ore. But I think that the regulators, Graham Samuel, if he gets a second five-year term, or his successor, would force the combined entity to sell off a few mines or to open up access to their infrastructure, the railways and the ports, to other parties, to other smaller iron ore companies. And we're seeing a number of them emerging at the moment. So there is 100 regulatory clearances that the BHP has to get before they can formally put their bid. You've got the European regulators, you've got South African, you've got competition in Australia. There's all sorts of regulations. So I think that this deal will be very, very very difficult and a long gestation period to get it done. And frankly, I think there are some downsides. I mean, I don't like the idea of such unfettered power in one corporate entity, although, you know, ultimately Australia would be profiteering, and it's the Chinese, the Japanese steel mills in particular, who be copying it in the neck with higher prices, hence they're complaining so much about it.
All right. Can I ask you quickly about the pulp mill proposal for Northern Tasmania that you're well across? Opponents of the mill are still talking about Gunns not yet securing finance for it. Jeffrey Cousins, one of the higher profile opponents, was talking yesterday about ANZ saying it would have made a decision by December and still hasn't announced one. Is financing going to be a problem for the project, do you think?
Well, I think the longer it drags on, the more question marks it raises, so particularly with this whole sort of global credit crunch. Raising debt has become a whole lot tougher, and raising debt for ethically challenging or environmentally challenging projects is also getting difficult with these sort of equator principles and principles for responsible investing, et cetera, which the likes of ANZ have signed up to. So I think you're right, Tim, that I think Jeffrey Cousins is right, that ANZ did say December, and I know the CEO, Mr. Smith, at the ANZ is privately saying he'd rather it wasn't having to fund this project. But he's got a corporate client of long standing to deal with, and he's got a lot of protesters. So, yeah, I think that there is still a degree of financing risk. I remember John Gay at the AGM last year basically scoffing at the financing risk and saying that this was not one of the higher risks facing the project, that he had absolutely no concerns about financing. Well, if that was the case, you'd think that the package would be announced by now. Mm. And so I'm surprised it hasn't been. And I would say there is still a degree of risk, and I think financing risk would be in the top couple of risks that still stand in front of the project.
Would Gunns be likely to encounter any difficulty obtaining finance offshore if that were what became necessary?
Well, I think ANZ were always going to produce a syndicate of lenders, a global syndicate of lenders. So, yeah, I think that's what often happens. If you get domestic institutions fearing consumer backlashes, then you go to institutions that don't have the consumer-facing vulnerability to a consumer boycott in Australia, such as, a Credit Suisse versus Boston or Rabobank or, any of these international banks. So, if obviously it all comes down to the terms, if the huge fees and Gunns paying a big premium on their interest rate, then you think you'd do it. But I must say, I'm still surprised that Gunns hasn't raised some new equity capital. I mean, it still is ridiculous that you've got a billion-dollar or $1.3 billion company attempting to build something which is worth more than its balance sheet. And I really would have thought that by now you would have actually had a decent share issue to actually properly fund your balance sheet, strengthen up your balance sheet, so you don't need to borrow more than $1 billion to get this thing done. So you'd only have to, say, borrow $600 or $700 million, and so the risk would be lower. So bit of a high wire act that John Gay is going down by refusing to raise shareholders' equity, and I'd suggest that would be one of the issues that a few of the bankers would be looking at as well, plus the fact that Gunns have never built a big mill and all those execution risks that exist as well.
Well, quickly, Stephen, we learnt yesterday a little of the timetable for the mill's construction and operation. Site clearing starts later this month, building starts in August. Would they be announcing these dates if the finance wasn't tied up or close to being tied up?
Well, you would assume not, but equally you would normally also assume that financing is one of the first things you do. I mean, you don't clear a site before you know you've got the dollars to actually build the thing. So I think it's all just sort of preparation stuff. I mean, they've been talking about getting this thing started, last year before the election at one point. So I think they obviously need to create the atmospherics that there's progress and there's momentum and they're ticking off various things as they go. But, they need Garrett to give the final say-so, and they need financing. They're the two, regulatory and financials are always the two biggest things. They haven't got everything lined up yet. They're making noises. But, frankly, the timetable has slipped considerably. I mean, when they first started out, who would have thought August 08 would be sod-turning day? So it's already slipping substantially, and until they actually get the announcement from ANZ, get the final approval from Garrett, I would suggest there remains a significant question mark over whether the project will proceed.
Stephen, thank you.
Thanks, Tim.
Good to talk to you, mate.